The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
You know, there are a lot of economic questions out there that are hard to answer. And so we thought we'd bring on somebody that has all the answers. At least we think he does. He's one of the best economists in the world. He's also a financial analyst and a commentator. You probably have seen him in all kinds of publications from Forbes magazine, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. He's president of A. Gary Schilling & Company, and he's editor of Gary Schilling's Insight. You ought to get a copy of it, folks. It's a tremendous, tremendous piece. If you're really serious about investing, if you're serious about either following your money or investing your money on your own, you need to subscribe to Gary Schilling's Insight. And we are pleased this morning to have him with us today. Good morning, sir.
Good morning to you.
And all right, Peggy told me the first thing I needed to ask you, much more important than any economic question.
But it does have an economic.
Is how are your bees?
Bees are in good shape. I'm glad you asked. This is a very crucial time of the year. This is the make or break time. But so far, it looks like they're bringing in lots of nectar and turning it into honey, as well as pollen, which is basically the protein they feed their larvae. Over the winter, I was pretty lucky. Of course, I spent a lot of time, and I've got part of my members of my staff who helped me, but we spent a lot of time on them. But we lost maybe 10% over the winter, and
wow.
That's on the low side on national numbers.
Right.
Wow.
I've seen some terrible numbers out there as far as it.
Yeah. In the last year, the losses, and these are nationwide average, and that was including the summer before last plus last winter, the total was 42% of hives died.
Mm-hmm.
And what was remarkable, 27% of that 42 happened last summer. Normally the losses in the winter are greater than in the summer, but last year it was the opposite. Heavy losses to be sure, but more toward the summer, which has got everybody scratching their heads.
So, but wasn't there some, Peggy, and we got to wrap this up, but wasn't there some, like, infection in the bees?
What's killing them off?
Well, they had a big study by all the big-name entomologists in the state universities, or Cornell, UC Davis, et cetera, plus USDA, and they came out with a report last year, and they said they think it's three things. But they didn't have a definitive answer. One is nutrition. There's just not as many wildflowers around for bees. Farmers are planting more fence row to fence row. A second one is a parasitic mite called Varroa, V-A-R-R-O-A. It hangs on the bees and sucks out their equivalent of blood. And the third one is pesticides. But the U.S. experts are not at all sure of that. And the European experts, who earlier were absolutely convinced it was pesticides, now are going back to the drawing boards. They say they're not sure. So it's disconcerting for all of us, the media, the beekeepers, et cetera, because you wish you knew the cause and you could find a magic bullet. But it's maybe a combination of things. But it just means it takes a lot more work and time and effort to keep the bees alive and producing. They're not going to disappear from the face of the earth, but it's a lot more time-consuming and expensive.
By the way, folks, you know, I told you earlier to go get a copy of Insight. Gary's included a little article called The Plight of the Honeybee in the June edition of the Insight, if you want to. I just think it's great. Anyway, Dr. Schilling, let's talk a little bit. Every morning I start out with kind of news of the day for the program, for the listeners. Every morning it starts with Greece. Can you give me a definitive? I mean, Greece has I understand it has the GDP of Maryland. Why do we care about what happens to Greece?
Well, there are two reasons, I think. One is the obvious domino effect. If Greece leaves, then what happens to the other Club Med South countries, Portugal, Italy, Spain? Are they next? Does the whole thing disintegrate? The other thing is that the whole Eurozone, it morphed out of a decision after World War II by the French and the Germans, who basically said, in almost these words, they said, we got to figure out a new way to communicate than the way we've been doing it for centuries, which is all-out war. And they figured if they could intertwine their economies sufficiently, that would reduce the odds of conflict. So it's really a grand noble experiment, if you will. And the feeling is if there is a country leave, that whole idea could unravel. And, of course, another thing is the people who had firsthand memories of World War II and even their children who heard about it from their parents are fading from the scene. You get down the road 20
right.
years and there won't be anybody with even secondhand information on it. So that zeal to keep Europe together to prevent military conflict will be less potent as we go forward.
Oh, interesting. Now, another question has been posed is that it's also kind of a harbinger of things to come because the Greeks haven't not learned how to pay their bills. You know, we have a pretty high deficit over here. I know it wouldn't come exactly the same, but are we in for some rough times over here with our if we don't get control of our deficit?
Well, we uniquely among countries have the ability to abuse our financial situation, and the reason is because the dollar is the world currency, and treasuries are considered about the safest investment around. So foreigners are pouring money into this country regardless. We're ahead of whoever's in second place. You know, we're the valedictorian in summer remedial school. We're the slowest falling rock. We're the tallest midget. We're not doing everything right, but we simply have the advantage over everybody else, and particularly over a small country like Greece that really doesn't have much economic clout.
So how do you read our economy right now? Is it hot, cold, warm? I mean, what does the porridge feel like to you?
It's lukewarm. Because it's continuing to mosey along. The growth adjusted for inflation in the total economic output, called gross domestic product, is running. It's at 2.2% compound annual rate of growth since the recovery started in the middle of 2009. Now, that's about half the speed you'd expect after the deepest recession since the 1930s. After a deep recession, you'd expect a strong recovery, but it's been moseying along at about half speed, and I think it'll continue. My explanation is that we're in the age of deleveraging. That's the title of a book I wrote in 2010. And in it, I forecast we'd have about 2% growth going forward, and that's what we've had so far. And the vast majority have constantly been looking for some big spurt in growth. Earlier it was a big deficit spending, the tax cuts, the big government spending programs. Then it was the Federal Reserve money, the quantitative easing, and so on. None of these things have really offset this tremendous deleveraging, people working off excess debt that was built up in the 80s and 90s. And that process is not completed, and until it is, I think we'll continue to have a slow growth.
So where do you come down on the when the Fed raises interest rate side? You know, we've heard all kinds of things. You know, they're going to raise it in June. It looks like we're going to get through June, September. Now I've even heard people say, okay, no, it's not going to be until next year. What do you think the Fed's going to do?
Well, if you look over the last several years, the Fed is always going to raise rates 6 months from now. It doesn't matter where you are. It's always 6 months from now. It's a rolling 6 months. And you look at their own forecast. We've got charts that show this. Starting in 2012, the Fed starts off with a forecast of real GDP growth of 4%, and then they crank it down to 2%. They did that for 2012, 2013, 2014, and so far in 2015. They start at 4%. And then they crank it down. So the Fed, like most forecasters, has looked for stronger growth. They look for stronger labor markets. They look for more inflation as opposed to deflation. And as a result, they see a faster, quicker rise in interest rates, and I think is probably going to be the case. I think it'll be postponed probably into next year and maybe later.
Wow. Yep, I agree with that too. So anyway, stay with us, folks. We'll be back in just a few moments. We've got Dr. Gary Schilling with us today.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We've got Dr. Gary Schilling with us. Dr. Schilling is really one of the preeminent economists in the United States. He's also the editor of A. Gary Schilling's Insight. And Dr. Schilling, if you don't mind, could you chat a little bit about Insight and maybe give the folks an idea of where they can go to maybe sign up for it?
Yeah, this is a monthly publication. It covers economic outlook. It's oriented toward investments. We list our investments, investment themes in it every month, and these are the themes that we use in running money. We eat our own cooking. We manage portfolios. And if anyone is interested, we'll send you a free issue. The toll-free number, 1-888-346-7444. And since we started off talking about honeybees and we give away all our honey, we'll include a free jar of honey of anybody who signs up with this within the next 2 weeks as a result of listening to this broadcast.
All right. And we will continue, by the folks, if you're driving, we will continue to give you the number as we go throughout the show. So, and if you still don't get it, if you're stuck in traffic somewhere, if you want to call us or send us an email, the Straight Talk Money, we will send that to you also. Because I really think you should get inside. It is a tremendous publication. Dr. Shilley, before the break, we were talking about the possibility of whether or not the Fed would raise interest rates. I want to get the stocks in a moment, but I wanted to ask you one thing. Do you see it going up very much? You know, the other argument that you get after that is, okay, yeah, all right, they're going to go up eventually, of course, maybe next year, maybe this year, maybe the year after, whatever. But it's just not going to go up very much, that we're pretty much going to be in a low interest rate environment for the foreseeable future. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think so, because as we talked in the first segment, I think we're in a period of we're in the age of deleveraging. We're in a period of slow economic growth, and as a result, labor markets are really not that tight. There's a lot of people working for less than they were before the Great Recession set in. A lot of people working part-time that would like to work full-time. They don't get as much pay. They don't get as much benefits. Most of the jobs created have been low-pay jobs in hotels, restaurants, and so on. They're not high-paid jobs in utilities, manufacturing, IT. If you look at the total numbers, the inflation-adjusted median household incomes and wages have basically been flat throughout this economic expansion. So this is not a strong economic environment, and that's one of the Fed's mandates is full employment, and the other one is price stability. They're worried about deflation more than they are inflation right now, and they have a 2% inflation target. They want a high enough target because they're so scared of deflation. They want a cushion, but right now they're basically prices, as they look at them, consumer prices, they use a different measure, but it's about the same. It's basically flat year over year and month over month.
Right. In fact, you were talking about in the current insight about oil prices remain volatile and deflation may well spread beyond the energy sector. If deflation were to come into our economy right now, what could the Fed do at zero interest rates? They've got very few weapons, if any, to fight deflation, do they?
Well, that's right, and that's why they the Fed and every other major central bank, the Bank of Canada, the Bank of Australia, Bank of New Zealand, Bank of Japan, European Central Bank, Bank of England, they all have 2% inflation targets because they don't love inflation, but they worry about deflation because of the example of Japan in the last two decades. What happens is, let's say somebody wants thinking about buying a car, but they're in a deflationary environment as Japan has been in for two decades, and they say, well, prices will be lower later. So they wait for lower prices. Everybody else waits. The cars pile up on the dealer's inventory. They have to cut prices to move them. People then look and say, hey, I was right. Prices went down. I'll wait even further. And the result is slow buying, slow economic growth. And that's what all the central banks worry about.
Right. All right, let me switch a little bit to the stock market before we lose you here. A lot of volatility in the market, a lot of going nowhere. You know, I mean, the market's had a lot of up and down this year, not a big wide range, of course. We haven't been up 500 or down 500. We've had a lot of activity, but we really seem to be treading water. I know a couple of weeks ago I was reading something for the show, and it basically said, okay, we're at zero for the year. We've gave up all the gains in the first quarter. We're at zero for the year. We may be under that now. Is that something that the investor can look farther ahead to, is just more and more volatility?
Yeah. Well, there are two things. One is that U.S. stocks have been basically going nowhere for the last 6 months, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that they are expensive. If you look at price-earnings ratios by a lot of measures, and we go into a lot of detail, but stocks are expensive. The other thing is that the earnings themselves have not been supported in this recovery by top-line growth, revenue growth. There hasn't been much unit volume growth with slow economic growth, and with no inflation, there's no pricing power. So the route to profits increase has been to cut costs, and most of those costs are labor costs. That's one of the reasons that real wages, inflation-adjusted wages, have been flat. Well, that cost-cutting did marvelous things, but it hasn't been working in the last couple of years. Whether they're scraping the bottom of the barrel or picked all the low-hanging fruit and have to wait for more to ripen remains to be seen. But you're not getting that anymore, so I think that you have a rather precarious situation there in terms of U.S. stocks. I don't think there, you know, there's no sign that we got a recession immediately or the Fed's going to raise rates immediately, the type of things that in the past would give you a big bear market, but I think there's limited upside potential in the U.S.
All right, so what about the foreign markets? Emerging markets?
We're much more interested right now in Japan and Europe, because they are going through the quantitative easing now right. That the Fed did earlier, and I think it'll have the same result. Most of that money that the Fed pumped out went into stocks, and I think we're probably going to see the same thing in Europe and Japan. Now, two caveats. One is, with the dollar strong and we think continuing to strengthen, you have to invest, you have to have a currency hedge approach to that, an ETF that's currency hedged or something, because otherwise you'll give back with a stronger dollar anything you make in local currencies. The other caveat is, if the U.S. stock market takes a tumble, and I'm not forecasting that, but if it does, you can bet your bottom dollar that you're going to see the same effects in Europe and Japan. In other words, if you have a big up or down day in the U.S., you know how things are going to open in Tokyo and then later in Europe tomorrow. They always is a follow through. We're just so dominant in finance that right. The rest of the world cannot operate very independently of the U.S.
Is there anything that really concerns you out there as you look at either the economic, the political landscape, the financial landscape? Is there something out there that really concerns you as an economist?
Well, you always have to be looking for the unknown. I've made sort of a career of looking for bubbles, and have had reasonably good success in spotting them. I don't see any great excesses there right now, nothing like the dot-com mania in the late 1990s and then the housing bubble in the 2000s. I don't see anything like that. But I think that with the Fed unlikely to raise rates, or at least raise them substantially anytime soon, that we may have this whole thing of stock market brought to a halt with some kind of a shock. And again, that could come out of the blue. It could be a blow up in the Middle East, or major European bank goes bust that nobody expects, or some big problem in China.
Well, and so nothing serious, just we have to keep our eyes open, I guess. So
yeah,
listen.
I think so. But as they say, it's in terms of U.S. stocks, this has been a long bull market, and in my view, it was supported by the Federal Reserve. We called it the grand disconnect between the stock market soaring with all the Fed money being pumped out and the economy on the ground, which has been limping along half speed.
Well, thank you, Dr. Schilling. We appreciate it being on with us today. Thank you very much, sir.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.